Welcome to The Art of Medicine, the program that explores the arts, business, and clinical aspects of the practice of medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Wilner. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Avais Aftab. When I was in medical school, my favorite professor was a psychiatrist, and I've interviewed several psychiatrists for The Art of Medicine. I've asked Dr. Aftab to talk about a strange phenomenon in our society, the opposition to psychiatry as a legitimate medical and scientific practice. Dr. Aftab is going to delve into this a little more and offer some suggestions on how psychiatrists and patients can better cope with those who don't believe in psychiatry. But before we get started, I'd like to thank our sponsor, locumstory.com. If you're considering locum tenens, either full-time or on the side, you probably have a question or two, or 20. Fortunately, locumstory.com has the answers you need. It's packed with unbiased information and advice from physicians like you. Locumstory.com has nothing to sell. It's simply a resource for information. You'll find super handy tools that let you see locums trends for your specialty, compare different locums agencies, and there's even a quiz to help you decide if locums is right for you. Locumstory.com is the perfect place to start if you want to learn more about locums. Okay, well, let's return to our guest. I'd like to welcome Dr. Avais Aftab to The Art of Medicine. Dr. Aftab, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Dr. Wilner.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. We were introduced virtually, as it often goes these days, by Dr. Pies, who I did an episode with. And in fact, I'm going to talk to him again soon on ReachMD because he's got a new book and we're going to, you know, review his new book. You know, he has nothing else to do but think, you know, and he's such a thoughtful, erudite guy that I really enjoy speaking with him. So he's been on this podcast, and I'll put that link in the show notes. But he referred me to you because he thought you might have some special insights into this topic. And as I said, you know, I've been interested in psychiatry for a long time. I almost became a psychiatrist instead of a neurologist. Because, you know, there's this brain-mind thing. And so I leaned a little bit over finally to the brain part versus the mind part. But I have to say that the mind part continues to intrigue me. So, okay, before we get too deep, tell me a little bit about your training and what you do now.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah. And I want to say Dr. Pies is a wonderful psychiatrist and a wonderful writer. I think we have benefited from his writings tremendously in the field. He was a former editor-in-chief for Psychiatric Times for many years, and his columns have been a staple at that magazine as well as other venues. So I'm really glad that that you've had Dr. Pies as a guest before and that he connected us. You've touched on a very complicated issue, so the relationship between mind and body, the relationship between psychiatry and neurology, and the complex social attitudes that we have towards the profession. Regarding my training and background, I'm from Pakistan originally. That's where I was born and raised. I did my med school there. And then I moved to US and I did my psychiatry residency. I did it in Cleveland at Case Western Reserve University, University Hospitals. And then I did a geriatric psychiatry fellowship in San Diego at UCSD. And since my training, I've been working in the inpatient setting, mostly with individuals with serious mental illness, and a lot of times with forensic populations and individuals with mental illness who might be facing legal charges. So I've had the opportunity to work with really vulnerable individuals who are facing a wide variety of difficulties and difficult social circumstances. And I have seen how they benefit from different sorts of therapeutic modalities.
Right, people can get better, right? People can get better.
They do. And I think there's this general sense of despair that often surrounds discussions of mental illness and psychiatry. And there's a sense that people don't get better or people don't improve. And that's really quite misplaced. I think there are different sorts of populations. I think there are certain patients who have a more chronic course and certain patients who have what we might call treatment resistance, that they don't respond as well to first-line treatments. But majority of patients actually respond quite well to medications and they go on to live very productive, meaningful lives. And this is especially the case with the more commonplace disorders like depression, anxiety, other forms of like adjustment disorder, PTSD, OCD. We have effective treatments that work and then people get better. And so I often find this attitude of nihilism around psychiatry somewhat frustrating.
So yeah, there's that. I mean, there's a perception that psychiatrists don't do anything, right? They don't have procedures, except for maybe ECT, and that's got its own story. But the psychiatrist sits there, patient talks, and then they write a script. I think that's like the common sort of perception of what a psychiatrist does, which it's like, well, I could do that. I could sit there and listen to somebody talk for 30 minutes, right? Or an hour, talk therapy. But so enlighten us a little bit more is when the psychiatrist is sitting there, say I'm your patient, I come in, I'm on the velvet couch there, and I'm going to tell you my problems, and you're sitting there, maybe you're taking notes, maybe you're reading the newspaper, I don't know. So what does the psychiatrist actually do?
Yeah, I think the interaction is actually, at least these days, mimics the standard medical diagnostic interview quite well. And we follow the same sorts of like history taking and clinical assessment that, you know, physicians in other specialties do, especially, for example, neurology, internal medicine, except that usually our histories do tend to be a lot more detailed and we get into a lot of sort of like depth of their prior sort of like, you know, medical and psychiatric history, their upbringing, social circumstances, other sorts of considerations, because we have to follow what is loosely called as the biopsychosocial model when we're doing data collection. So the first part is really this comprehensive history taking, where we get a sense of what are the ongoing problems, what sort of symptoms they have had, what is the time course of those symptoms, what prior psychiatric issues they have, what medical issues they might be. And there's this complex judgment of, you know, when a psychiatric problem might be related to a diagnosed or undiagnosed general medical problem. And so we sort of like, we do that. And then there's the complex process of differential diagnosis, because symptoms by themselves don't tell you exactly what the diagnosis is. You have to look at the ways in which the symptoms are existing, their history, the relationship to context. We sort of like take all of that into account. We come up with a diagnosis or a differential diagnosis. We decide what medical workup is needed in order to rule out any kind of neurological or medical problem that might be hiding behind the symptoms. And once we have arrived at some sort of a diagnosis, we create what is called a diagnostic formulation, because diagnosis in psychiatry are descriptive. They are at the level of the symptoms, at the level of the syndromes. And we have to add contextual information from other aspects of history to that to create a sense of what we think might be going on and what are the modifiable factors in this person's life and this person's circumstances that we need to act on. And then there's the decision, sort of like what medications to initiate, whether to initiate medications, what sort of medications might offer the best benefit versus side effect profile. And different medications have different side effect profiles, and different patients have different preferences regarding what sort of side effects might be more tolerable to them. there's the issue of whether they need psychotherapy, and if so, what sort of psychotherapy they need, whether this is something that the psychiatrist can offer themselves, or whether this is something that requires a referral to a different psychotherapist or a psychologist. In some cases, we might even need neuropsychological testing for clarification. And you know, other issues such as, you know, whether any referral to social work is needed, or whether the patient's presentation is such that we might consider some kind of neuromodulation interventions, such as transcranial magnetic stimulation or ECT. So there's a lot going on. It's certainly not as simple as just sitting back and listening to a patient. We're doing everything that a usual physician does, and in fact, a lot more.
That actually sounds very straightforward. So why is it that psychiatry isn't looked at the same as the other medical professions by many lay people?
Yeah, there's a complex history to that. One is that the manner in which psychiatry has been practiced has differed dramatically over the years, or decades, over centuries. And psychiatry has looked very different at different points in history. If, for example, if you look at 1950s, 1960s, the decades after the Second World War, American psychiatry was dominated by psychoanalysis. And that was the favored model, where the Freudian and psychoanalytic way of thinking was the most dominant. The best treatment modalities were thought to be psychotherapeutic. In-depth psychoanalysis, such as the one where the patient lays down on the couch and there are multiple sessions in a week, those were considered the best forms of treatments. So psychiatry at that time looked very different versus, for example, how it looked in the 80s and 90s, when we had the availability of a lot more effective psychotropic medications, when antidepressants became more widely available, and when we had more a wide variety of medications approved. And psychiatry shifted to a much more standard, what is called medical model. In the 50s and 60s, psychiatric diagnosis was not considered a very high priority thing by the average psychiatrist. They were much more interested in developing a psychological formulation using psychoanalytic ideas, versus in 1980, when DSM-3, which is the modern version of the psychiatric diagnostic manual, when that came out, there was a shift in the field. And diagnosis became the central framework around which assessment and treatment was centered and oriented around that. And then treatment guidelines shifted accordingly as well. So I think a lot of people, when they think about psychiatry, especially older people in the population, older patients, older physicians, they often think back to how psychiatry was in the 60s, 70s, when things are quite different now.
Okay, I'm going to throw this out. What about Scientology? What's that all about? You know, Tom Cruise, he's one of my favorite actors, but apparently psychiatry is off the table. And I've had patients who clearly have distressing psychiatric symptoms of depression or anxiety. And I've had situations said, well, you know, maybe a psychiatrist could help you. No, not going to a psychiatrist. I mean, what's going on there? What's that all about?
Yeah, I think it's psychiatry is somewhat unique among the medical disciplines, that it has a very formal as well as informal resistance from many different sections of society. And there's a complex history there, which often kind of like gets referred to by the entry psychiatry movement. And we don't have to go into the historical details of this, but there's this sort of like this general, various people in the population, in society, have resisted and have attacked and critiqued psychiatry from its very early days. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, when psychiatry was primarily asylum-based, when it was dealing primarily with people who were admitted to the insane asylums at that time, resistance was focused a lot on the rights of the mentally ill, who were often kept in those asylums for very long periods and without a lot of due process. So resistance at that time was a social phenomenon based on human rights and the rights of the mentally ill. When community psychiatry and outpatient psychiatry became more prominent and predominant after the Second World War, the resistance to psychiatry also kind of changed and took a different form. In the 50s and 60s, when psychoanalysis was the dominant modality, a lot of critique was directed at that, and that people questioned the scientific basis of psychoanalysis. They questioned how much empirical support it had, and they questioned how effective it was. And at that time, psychiatry had pathologized many conditions, such as, for example, homosexuality at that time was still recognized as a formal disorder, which was subsequently declassified as a mental disorder in the 1970s. And at that time, in the early days, when ECT was being used, it was used in the early days without anesthesia, and often high doses of electricity were used. So it tended to be a quite traumatic experience for the patients who underwent ECT in those early days. And some of those depictions we might remember from movies such as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So they created a very negative perception of psychiatry and psychiatric treatments in the general public. So there was a sentiment that psychiatry is pseudoscientific, that it doesn't really rely on adequate scientific methodology, that its treatments are barbaric, that there's a pattern of human rights violation, and patients are often admitted or coerced into treatment without due process. And there was some truth to that. There were definitely a lot of problems in psychiatry in those days. But over the years, over the decades, a lot of those problems have been addressed. The scientific methodology used in psychiatry now is at par with the rest of medicine. We sort of like, we have similar sorts of peer-reviewed journals, we have psychiatric researchers, funders, similar sort of scrutiny, and findings in general hold up pretty well. We have effective medications whose efficacy has been replicated in multiple clinical trials, medications that have been approved by regulatory agencies. Interventions like ECT are much safer now. They're administered under anesthesia. The electricity dosage is carefully monitored. We are much more aware of the side effects. We're much more aware of human rights issues. So the profession has gone a long way in trying to address those concerns, but the stigma from the old days persists. And many people still have those sort of like old stereotypes in mind when they think about psychiatry. Organizations like Scientology have made psychiatry a particular target. The reason why Scientology got involved, so fixated on psychiatry, has to do with the personal history of the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard. He himself had psychiatric difficulties. He initially had favorable interactions with psychiatrists, but later on his experiences turned negative, and he developed his own ideas about nature of mental problems, which are widely recognized as being pseudoscientific, along with a lot of other things in Scientology. But he developed a severe antagonism and animosity towards the profession, mm-hmm. which he elevated to the status of dogma. And everyone who was indoctrinated into the school of Scientology, you can say, basically had to adopt those attitudes towards psychiatry, and it's kind of unfortunate. And they have been really persistent in attacking psychiatry in any way they can. Oftentimes, they organize protests around the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association. They have created an anti-psychiatry museum in California. It's called the Museum of Death, that is devoted to attacking and criticizing psychiatry. So in the case of Tom Cruise, he was expressing, and he has been expressing, the standard Scientology view against psychiatry. And because he's a celebrity and a high profile status, his views sort of like, you know, get a lot of promotion and get hired by a lot of people, even though they have no credibility in the scientific professions.
All right. So I guess it's just a call for more education. And, you know, I'm an epileptologist, take care of people with seizures and epilepsy. And there was a, it's fading, but it's still there. There's a stigma to having, you know, epilepsy and seizures. And it was much worse, you know, 50 years ago. People, it's gradually becoming accepted that, yeah, this is, you know, a medical illness, which often has comorbidities that are psychiatric. So I've worked very closely with psychiatrists in the past to kind of have a dual approach to many of these patients. But eliminating stigma through education, I guess, is has to be a bumper sticker for neurologists and psychiatrists going forward. Well, before we wrap up, there was one other topic I wanted to broach with you, and that's the other criticism I hear a lot is overuse of medications. You know, that sometimes you turn, you know, there was that book, Listening to Prozac, right? Mm-hmm. And like the moral of the story was everybody needs Prozac, you know, life is tough. And for a time there, it was hard to meet someone who didn't seem to be on an anti-anxiolytic or an antidepressant. And of course, many of these were prescribed by non-psychiatrists as well, you know, that take some responsibility. So let's see. So where to start? Do you think that these medications are overused in North America?
It's, you know, it's hard to say for sure because we don't have good standards for determining, you know, at the population level, like what percentage of the population should be on medication and, you know, and what levels might be considered appropriate. I think generally speaking, from looking at the overall evidence, looking sort of like, you know, based on my personal observation and experience, I do think these medications are overprescribed. And this is also, this also has to do a lot with structural issues. Not everyone who has anxiety difficulties or depression or depressive disorders, et cetera, needs to be on medication. Many of them could benefit, for example, from psychotherapy, and they might respond well to that, might stay well. But access to psychotherapy is very limited in the US. It's very hard to find psychotherapists. And even when you find them, it's very hard to find someone who would take your insurance or where you would get adequate insurance reimbursement. So access to psychotherapy is very limited, which means that one of the main modalities that that we have for effective treatment in psychiatry is accessible to many patients, especially in the public system. That leaves medication. So I think if we can make psychotherapy, if we can make other forms of social support more accessible, the reliance on medications would certainly go down. So that's one reason. Another thing is that it is the case that the majority of antidepressants, for example, are prescribed by primary care physicians in the US. 80 to 90% of prescriptions of antidepressants are coming from primary care physicians. So the milder sorts of cases, psychiatrists are not seeing them for the most part. It's the primary care physicians that are seeing them. And they often have challenges of their own. They don't have enough time to do a detailed comprehensive assessment. So for example, where a psychiatrist might get, you know, 30 minutes or 45 minutes with a patient, they might only get 15, 20 minutes. So they are short of time, they're short of resources. So they have to be much more efficient and quick in the diagnosis that they give, they reach, and the medication or the treatment they have to offer. So the way primary care is structured, those constraints also incentivize the use of medications and reliance on those medications. So there are, I do think there are these deeper structural issues. And you mentioned Listening to Prozac, and you know, it was one of the books that made antidepressants a cultural phenomena. But Dr. Peter Kramer, his discussion is actually quite nuanced. And in his own practice, in the cases that he was describing, he was combining both medication and psychotherapy. And that sort of practice model where you're following with a physician or a psychiatrist over the long term who knows you very well, and where antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications are being offered in the context of long-term psychotherapy, that model has unfortunately disappeared from American psychiatry and American medicine due to the restrictions of managed care and other sorts of changes.
Wow. Okay. So as you said at the beginning that it is complex, sounds like a lot of the blame doesn't fall on psychiatrists per se, that there's a lot of systemic structural limitations and constraints that sort of lean towards medications versus listening to the patient and finding out exactly what's going on and seeing whether psychotherapy or other supportive therapy can help.
Yeah, I agree. I would say just briefly that I think in the beginning in the 90s, there was push by the pharmaceutical companies at promoting antidepressants in a way that was quite excessive. And pharmaceutical companies were really behind the narrative of chemical imbalance that mental illnesses such as depression are primarily caused by mental illness. And they use pharmaceutical advertisements and other things to promote that, and it became a cultural meme. Those sorts of efforts also, I think, shifted patient preferences towards medications in a way that was not entirely justified.
Yes. Okay. Dr. Aftab, anything else you would like to add before we wrap up?
No, I think we had an interesting discussion, and I hope the listeners would find it worthwhile.
Dr. Aftab, I want to thank you very much for joining me on The Art of Medicine.
Thank you so much.
Before we close, I'd like to give another thanks to our sponsor, locumstory.com, a resource where providers can get real, unbiased answers about locum tenens. I'm Dr. Andrew Wilner. See you next time.
This program is hosted, edited, and produced by Andrew Wilner, MD, FACP, FAAN. Guests receive no financial compensation for their appearance on The Art of Medicine. Andrew Wilner, MD, is Associate Professor of Neurology at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center, Memphis, Tennessee. Views, thoughts, and opinions expressed on this program belong solely to Dr. Wilner and his guests, and not necessarily to their employers, organizations, or other group or individual. While this program intends to be informative, it is meant for entertainment purposes only. The Art of Medicine does not offer professional financial, legal, or medical advice. Dr. Wilner and his guests assume no responsibility or liability for any damages, financial or otherwise, that arise in connection with consuming this program's content. Thanks for watching. For more episodes of The Art of Medicine, please subscribe. www.andrewwilner.com